All right. Well, thank you all for hanging in. It might seem like a long and circuitous path, right? Talking about the founders' religious views and the core truths of history. So today we're going to be as timely as is possible to be, I think. Over the last decade, but particularly over the last few years, we have seen a number of conflicts arise between religious liberty and same-sex marriage and related issues, non-discrimination ordinances, SOGI statutes, and so forth. And so I sort of want to pull things together and look at this very contemporary conflict and then look at American history and make an argument about why I think we can very well protect religious liberty even in these fairly unfriendly times, at least, you know, maybe not so much in Montana, but certainly in a place like Oregon and Washington and maybe even at the national scene. So the question is often asked, and there's a lot of fear out there, I think. What is Obergefell, the U.S. Supreme Court decision requiring every state in the union to recognize same-sex marriage? What sort of impact might this have on religious liberties? I've literally talked to pastors who are thinking maybe we'll stop having weddings in our church so that we don't get sued the first time two men show up and want to get married and we say no. You've all heard of these cases involving small business owners who refuse to participate in same-sex wedding ceremonies, florists and bakers and others. Institutions like George Fox University are scared, running scared. Just this morning, I was checking the news, and I saw that Grand Canyon University has decided they've become the third Christian college to give benefits to same-sex couples that are employed by Grand Canyon University or elsewhere. Why are they doing this? The president was up in front, I saw a little interview, he said, well, yeah, marriage was designed to be between a man and a woman. Grand Canyon sells itself as a Christian institution. Why would they do that? Even a conservative, orthodox one. I think in part it's out of fear, right? They're just out of fear. There was an employee who's married to a woman married to a woman, who was threatening a lawsuit, and they just decided to give in and say, okay, we'll just go down this path. So what exactly is the threat? How dire is the threat and what are possible solutions? Let me begin, and I should preface all of this by saying that I am not an attorney and I cannot give legal advice, but I think the First Amendment hopefully protects my ability to engage in freedom of speech and I can talk about these issues and share them. But of course, if you have a question about a specific case, you'd certainly want to go to the Alliance Defending Freedom and talk to a real attorney that could represent you far better than me. Let me first of all calm some fears, I think. So I've been spending a lot of time on this issue. I was an expert in the Flores case in Washington. I've been working pretty closely with ADF attorneys and CLS attorneys on these sorts of matters. So I'm pulling from a pretty wide range of knowledge here. I've been reading everything I can find get my hands on from the literature, the law review literature and others. So with respect to churches and clergy, I want to suggest the threat right now and for the foreseeable future is almost zero. In the oral arguments over Obergefell, the attorney Mary Bonato, who was representing gay couples, was asked if it was conceivable that a minister could be forced to participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony. This ACLU attorney said, absolutely not. No clergy is going to be compelled in this fashion. The protections in place are there already. Just recently, Obama gave a speech about this issue where he said a similar thing. I've read a lot of literature, and of course, a lot of law professors are on the left. Virtually no one is arguing that clergy or houses of worship should be compelled to engage in religious ceremonies against their convictions. All right? When Washington, that actually passed legislation to legalize same-sex marriage, they specifically passed legislation to protect churches and religious organizations, making it clear they couldn't be compelled in this sort of area. And Washington is a very, very liberal and secular state. I think there's a pretty general understanding that if religious liberty means anything, it means that the state can't tell a member of the clergy that they have to engage in a particular ceremony. So this, I'm not saying we shouldn't be vigilant, but I'm saying of all the things you have to worry about, and there's a number of things you maybe should be worried about, this should not be high on the list for any time in the foreseeable future. Far more questionable are religious organizations. So if you notice the sort of language I'm using, clergy and houses of worship, by which I mean the sort of church you might go to on Sunday morning, right? These are very well protected. What about religious organizations? I took the liberty of putting my own George Fox up there, Bob Jones University, Carroll College, a college in your state with Catholic affiliation. To what extent do these organizations have to worry? They're not churches. They are thoroughly religious, but not churches. Here, your level of worry needs to go up. And particularly, you probably are picking up on this reference to Bob Jones. Bob Jones University is a fundamentalist school in South Carolina. The founder of Bob Jones, who's Bob Jones, as you might imagine, run by three generations of Bob Jones. I think for the first time they have someone other than a Bob Jones. There's Bob Jones the first, the second, and the third. They now have someone else as president. So it began as a fairly openly fundamentalist school. Initially, they would admit people of any race except African Americans. All right, we won't admit African American, but interestingly, Asians, Hispanics, that was okay. In the 1970s, the school began to admit married African Americans. And then finally, it began in the mid-70s to admit anyone of any race, but it had a prohibition on interracial dating. All right, these fundamentalists, and I don't even think all fundamentalists believe this, not by a long stretch, and Bob Jones has since repudiated this doctrine, but reading biblical texts like Numbers 12:1, which states that, I'm going to quote here, Miriam and Aaron spake against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they take texts like this and say, look, the Bible clearly prevents or rejects interracial marriage. This is something the Bible tells us not to do. And so, to ensure this doesn't happen as a school rule, we're going to have a ban on interracial dating. So know what's going on here. African Americans can come to Bob Jones. Asians can come. Whites can come. And note that the ban works on everyone, right? It's not like only African Americans are restricted. If you're a white student at Bob Jones, you can't go off and date an Asian American or whatever. So it's a broad ban. Well, this is all fine. But the IRS got wind of this, and the IRS said, you know what? This policy goes against longstanding public policy of the United States government to combat racial discrimination. And so, therefore, we are not going to allow you to have your 501c3 status. You're not going to be a tax-exempt institution. Donations to your organization will no longer be tax-exempt. This is a huge blow, as you might know, to a religious organization. There's lots and lots of benefits to this. If I want to give money to Bob Jones, if I give $100 and I'm in the 30% income tax bracket, I basically get $30 of that back, right? Because my donation is tax deductible. Now I can still give money to Bob Jones, but I don't get a tax deduction. Obviously, it hurts the ability to raise funding. So a very, very valuable benefit is removed from this organization. This is where it gets scary. Incidentally, Bob Jones, since it's repudiated this doctrine, I think they might be trying to get this back. It is interesting, I will point out, just for the record, that Bob Jones was still allowed to exist. It wasn't as if the federal marshals came up and arrested all the president and all the professors and marched him off. So Bob Jones is still there. It's still in operation, just without this very important benefit. Well, the fear of places like George Fox University is that they might come after the tax-exempt status that we enjoy if we refuse, say, to give benefits to same-sex couples. In the arguments over Obergefell, the Solicitor General of the United States, Donald Verrilli, was asked by Scalia, is it conceivable that Christian colleges could lose their tax-exempt status if we rule in favor of same-sex marriage? And he said, you know, I don't think I can answer that question without knowing more, but it's certainly going to be an issue. I don't deny that. I don't deny that at all. It's going to be an issue. All right, so here is the Solicitor General of the United States saying if this decision comes down this way, this will become an issue. George Fox University, in order to teach there, you have to be an Orthodox Christian. You have to abide by traditional Christian understandings of morality with respect to, saying, not having sex outside the bounds of marriage, being married to a woman, and this sort of thing. We sign off on these sorts of requirements. And so conceivably, these requirements in and of themselves could be used to yank tax-exempt status from us. Now, the IRS commissioner has since said several times after Obergefell that we aren't going to go after religious colleges. But of course, IRS commissioner serves at the pleasure of the president. We're going to have a new president. Who knows what his or her priorities might be with respect to this. So it's a threat. It's a real threat. There are things, incidentally, the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Christian Legal Society, has some great guidance about what organizations can do to protect themselves, having clear standards, being consistent about those standards, some draft policy language that can be adopted, both for churches and for religious organizations. So it's only wise to prepare oneself in these sorts of things. So your level of worry should be, I don't know, if there's no worry for churches and clergy, it should be at the yellow level at least for religious organizations. What about private businesses? Here you should be seeing alarm bells and hearing alarm bells, seeing red flags, flashing lights and whatnot. The courts have been very unfriendly to protecting private business owners when it comes to these sorts of statutes. I mentioned briefly this was kind of how I got involved in this business. Last fall, the Alliance Defending Freedom came to me and said, we would like you to be an expert in the case of Baron L. Stutzman, a florist up in Washington. Let me tell you, you're probably familiar with their story, but in case you aren't, I need to give you some background because it is such a powerful story. So Baron L. Stutzman has been a florist for 35 years. For 9 years, she knowingly served the same-sex couple. So this is not an irrational homophobe. I mean, she knew these two men were dating each other. They were partners. One of them would come in and say, I need some flowers for my boyfriend's birthday. And, you know, they would work together. I read all these depositions. It was really quite amazing. You know, $4,500 worth of business that they did. Baron L. Stutzman hires, apparently, homosexuals. So with respect to hiring, so she's not homophobe. But she heard through the grapevine after Washington legalized same-sex marriage that these two men whom she had served for a long time were going to get married. And she went home and talked to her husband about it. And they decided, man, we just cannot participate in this. And when you read through the deposition, it's clear she believes that she's an artist. And I don't deny that, right? That it's not just a matter of cutting flowers and handing them out, that there's a lot of art that goes in, what sort of flowers where and what context. She would go to the location, decide what works best. She saw herself as a participant in the same-sex wedding ceremony that she thought was just profoundly offensive to God. So the young man came, maybe not so young, and he said, yeah, I have good news for you, Baron L. I'm getting married. Will you do the flowers for my wedding? And she hugged him and said, I'm sorry, I just can't do this. And she took the time to find another florist that would be willing to do it. So she gave him a referral. Now, in a world of grown-ups, I would think this would be the end of it, right? It's kind of a little sad, maybe a little touching, but the man goes to the store 5 minutes away and gets flowers for the wedding, and no one has to go to jail. Well, Baron L. Stutzman didn't go to jail, but the attorney general of the state came down on her like a ton of bricks. This young man eventually got the ACLU to bring a suit on their behalf. There's now an injunction against her engaging in this sort of behavior, which could be a direct threat to her business, and more significantly, a fine of $135,000 has been levied against her by a district court judge in Washington. All right, now these cases are being appealed, and of course, there's lots of other cases I'm sure you've heard about. The Sweet Cakes case in Oregon, a baker in a very similar situation, a photographer. Again, when you read these things, this is not, it's not just simply a simple business where you kind of show up and take a picture, but this photographer feels that there's a lot of artistic effort that goes into this, that she's a full participant in this wedding, and so that she can't, in good conscience, participate in this wedding ceremony. So these cases have been going on in Colorado and elsewhere. The courts have been very, very unfriendly to these claims of religious liberty over and against state statutes prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So we do need to be very worried. And particularly for folks in a place like this, right? For some Christians, it might be the case that you say, well, I'm a Christian. I worship God on Sunday morning. I don't drink too much beer and so forth. But, my business is just a business. Hopefully, all of you all are committed to the idea that, no, your business isn't just a business. It should be a thoroughly Christ-centered business. Our faith should inform how we run our business. And this might mean we do certain things. I read the biography of the founder of Hobby Lobby. This one story from early on kind of caught my eye. When the Hobby Lobby was still pretty small, but they had dozens of stores, he started thinking, why are we open on Sunday? Maybe I shouldn't be open on Sunday. It's God's day. It's a Sabbath. But if you're a hobby store, the weekend is critically important, right? I mean, hobbies are kind of things you do for fun in your spare time. It's not like a grocery store where people might go at various times. So you want both days of the weekend. But he became convicted that God would have him close his stores on Sunday. But, you know, how convicted? Maybe I'll just close the stores in Nebraska, he thought. I only have two stores in Nebraska, and we'll see how it works out. But then he thought through it a bit more, and he said, no, if it's the right thing to do, I ought to do it, regardless of the economic consequences. And so he didn't. To this day, Hobby Lobby is not open on Sunday. That's the sort of thing I presume Big Sky is trying to help people think through, right? How should our faith impact what we do? And I'm not saying he's necessarily right. If you're a business owner who's open on Sunday, you know, that's between you and God to sort out. But we can at least appreciate his ability to think these things through and to act upon them, just as we can for the Kleins and Stutzman and others. All right, so what's the solution to this? Let me just briefly run through what I think could be done, what has been done historically. This is based on a much longer paper, a fully documented paper, if you're interested in these sorts of details, that is easily accessible online at the Heritage Foundation. I wrote this, is basically my expert brief became this paper, and it's coming out in a couple of different forums, making an argument. And the argument simply is this. America has a long and noble history of accommodating religious belief, of saying we can concede the state has an interest in something, and it passes a general, neutrally applicable law, okay? And generally, we don't want to have a lot of exceptions to the law, but historically, American legislators at the state and national level, and sometimes courts get involved and say no. Generally, we don't want a lot of exceptions out the kazoo, but religious liberty is so important that we're going to make the effort to carve out exceptions for religious individuals. And even in areas of utmost national importance or state importance, we can still accomplish what we hope to accomplish by these laws, even though we're granting a few exceptions to them because of sincere religious belief. We have done this time and time again, and the nation's been able to meet very important policy objectives, and I think we could easily do this in this area. So let me just give you an example of how this might work, beginning with our friends, the Quakers. Okay, so think about this. The early colonial settlements have requirements that all males must serve in the militia. Now, this is really important back in the 17th century, even the early 18th century. You know, there were times where European Americans came close to getting pushed off the continent by Native American tribes. I mean, it's a scary, tenuous place. And so it makes a lot of sense that we're going to have everyone be a part of this militia. We don't have a standing army. We don't have English troops stationed here. And so people need to know how to fight, to be able to fight in an organized fashion. Well, that's fine. Well, we have these Quakers that come over to America, and they're troublemakers, and they're chased out of Massachusetts and so forth. But, you know, they're down in Pennsylvania. But eventually they get a bit more widespread, and the act of toleration that Parliament passes pretty much tells New England, you guys have to let these people exist and live in New England. So the question comes, well, you know, these Quakers are pacifists, and they said, look, we can't fight. We won't fight as a matter of religious conviction. We won't fight. Well, just step back a minute and think what we should do here. All right? One answer, one possibility, there's three obvious possibilities. One is to say, you will fight or you will go to jail. Simple as that. Many, many countries do that, right? Can you imagine a pacifist in China telling the government, I'm a religious pacifist. I don't want to fight in the army. Yeah, right. Bam, off to jail you go. And this is more often the rule than not. So that is a possibility. And it's really important to have these militias for our defense, right? Okay, that's one option. The other option might be to say, well, you know, religious liberty is so important that we'll just get rid of this militia statute altogether. But that leaves us open to some really imminent threats, right? We might not be able to defend ourselves if we get rid of the militia statute altogether. So far more commonsensical, it seems to me, is to leave the statute in place, say, look, males, you guys all have an obligation to serve in the militia, but you religious pacifists, you Quakers, we're not going to make you serve in the militia, but we are going to require you to pay a fine to sort of help do your duty. The fine could then be used to buy gunpowder or whatnot. So you're contributing to the defense, and if you aren't willing to do that, you're in trouble. Well, over time, these exemptions have been expanded pretty significantly. In World War I, the Selective Service Act basically allowed members of historic peace churches to do non-combat service. So again, you're doing something, just we aren't going to force you to fight. This was challenged, incidentally, as a violation of the Establishment Clause. If you think about it, you could argue, and people did argue, this is unfair. You know, a lot of people don't go to war. These Quakers don't have to go to war, but other people do, right? Some people volunteered, of course, but then some people are forced. The U.S. Supreme Court laughed this out of the court, 9-0. They say, no, accommodating religious belief is not a violation of the Establishment Clause. It's not creating a national church or state church or anything approximating that. Unfortunately, from my perspective, in 1940, the Selective Service Act of 1940 was actually expanded to include all religious pacifists. Now, you think about these two wars I mentioned, World War I, World War II. We really had some manpower needs in these wars, particularly World War II, and yet we were still able to protect religious convictions and win these wars. It was not detrimental to the common good. We could meet the very important need of national security, even as we protected the rights of religious pacifists. All right, let me just run through a few more, and again, I could give a lot more cool details of how these things developed, and oftentimes I try to make a point of saying these accommodations are not Republican things. They really aren't. They were just as likely to be supported by Democrats and Republicans alike, by liberals and conservatives alike. I mean, religious liberty really, until a decade ago, has been an American value, where people come on board and support it. Well, oaths. We talked about this a little bit this morning. Let me quote from George Washington, the farewell address. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indisputable supports. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity. Let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation deserts the oaths, which are the instruments of the investigation of courts of justice? So oath-taking, incredibly important. People, Washington articulated here, everyone believed this, that loyalty oaths, judicial oaths, we have to be able to trust that people are telling the truth. And so to take an oath with God as a witness, of course, is a critical part of this. This is absolutely quintessentially important, right? We don't tend to think that as much nowadays, but we're a very different culture, obviously. What about our Quaker friends? This isn't all about Quakers, but we'll go to them yet again, because you probably know Quakers do not believe in taking oaths. And they actually have some biblical support for this. There are several verses, but I'll read one, James 5:12. But of all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven nor earth, neither by any oath. Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. Most of us don't interpret this verse in this way, but the Quakers do. And you can see this is not unreasonable. It seems to say pretty clearly, do not take any oath. All right, so what are we going to do with the Quakers? Well, England had a solution. They persecuted them. They threw them in jail. They threw them in dark, dingy places where literally thousands of them died. Fortunately, eventually, the Quakers, they persevered. They were a hardy lot. Now, Quakers, and I teach at a Quaker school. It's broadly evangelical, but we come from the French tradition. They make a distinction, and I'm not going to defend the distinction, but they make it, and it's meaningful for them. They will not swear an oath, but they are not bothered by making an affirmation. They think that's okay. So if you were to see a Quaker testify for a criminal trial, you'll see something like this. Do you swear or affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth? And the Quaker will say, I so affirm. That's not taking an oath in their mind. Well, why is that relevant here? One of the reasons it's relevant is because the U.S. Constitution itself contains a religious accommodation. There are three oath requirements in the Constitution. The best well-known is the oath of office for the president. Note what this writes. In the U.S. Constitution itself, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office and so forth. This is an accommodation clearly aimed at Quakers. There's a few other small Christian sects that follow the Quakers in this. And again, is there any reason to believe that our judicial system has been imperiled, that Quakers have been more disloyal because they don't swear and they're granted an ability to affirm? I don't think there is. It's simply not a good argument. All right, real quickly, looks like I want to leave plenty of time here. Mandatory school attendance. So in the 19th century, you know, you kind of get to choose what you want to do. But beginning in the mid-19th century and picking up steam in the 20th century, states got pretty involved in saying, we require you to go to school. all right? Now, this makes a lot less sense to a lot of my students today because they say, well, what's the big deal? The parent could just homeschool or he could have a private school, right? It actually, prior to like 1970, was really difficult and almost unheard of to homeschool. And even creating private Christian schools or private schools in general was very onerous, very difficult. And so, you know, what do you do then? What do you do particularly if you're, say, the Amish? The Amish, this famous case of Wisconsin versus Yoder, these Amish in New Glarus, Wisconsin, they actually didn't object to sending their children to the local elementary school to learn to read and write and do arithmetic. But they said, our faith does not allow us to send them off to middle school, where they'll become corrupted, and this goes against our faith, and this sort of thing. Wisconsin wouldn't budge. Wisconsin says, no, you must. Education is so important that we can't make exceptions for you guys. This case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court, on the basis of the Free Exercise Clause, says, no, the state has a really good reason for requiring compulsory attendance, but if we want to override the Amish objections, it has to be a really compelling reason, and it ain't. Okay, education is very important, we all agree, but it's not as if the Amish just stop educating their kids at age 16. What they do is they apprentice them. They teach them how to be farmers, and the Amish take care of themselves. And so the Amish do, in fact, have a free exercise right not to send their children to public schools based on the U.S. Constitution. All right, this is one of my favorite. We said the pledge last night. As America entered World War II, some states decided that national unity is paramount. And one of the ways in which we will implement this is by requiring public school children to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag. Some of you might even remember in the way olden days, the way this was done is by what we now think of as a sort of Hitler salute, where you go like this, I pledge allegiance to the flag, and so forth. Well, this is fine. The problem, of course, as you probably can guess already, is that there are some Americans who believe you should not pledge allegiance to the American flag, particularly the Jehovah's Witnesses. Again, they have biblical support. Most of us don't interpret these verses in this way, but verses such as Exodus 20, 4 and 5, against worshiping graven images, they see this in their minds. This is nothing other than worshiping a graven image. This case went to the U.S. Supreme Court first in 1940, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, look, national unity is so important that we're going to force these Jehovah's Witness kids to pledge allegiance to the American flag, and if they don't, they'll be expelled from schools, and then their parents can be fined because they're violating these compulsory attendance statutes. All right? Fortunately, very fortunately from my perspective, the court revisited this issue just 3 years later. And the court said this, the very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the court, one's right to life, liberty, and property, free speech, free press, free freedom of worship and assembly cannot be violated by majority votes. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. If there are any circumstances which permit an exception, they do not occur to us now. In other words, the state cannot force these Jehovah's Witness children to say something they don't believe or to engage in what they consider to be an act of worship against their religious conviction. This is a fixed star of our constitutional constellation. Let me just suggest, I think this has an immediate bearing on the Baronel Stutzman case. So I've argued with academics about this. And one of the things they routinely say is they will say, and even Christians have said this to me, and they said, well, what's a big deal? Business owners serve all sorts of people that engage in acts that they might disagree with, right? They serve divorcees, they serve non-Christians and others, and they're just engaging in business. They aren't participating in the ceremony, right? Is she really even participating just by visiting the place and selling them flowers? It's not participation. That is not an unreasonable view. If you hold that view, I say more power to you. If you're a florist that has no problem serving two women who are getting married, even though you believe as a Christian that marriage should be between a man and a woman, I say more power to you. That's for you to work out with your own conscience and so forth. What's critically important, though, is to recognize sometimes people come to conclusions with which we disagree. I don't agree with the Jehovah's Witnesses at all on this point, but I think they should not be compelled to engage in this act against their conviction. In the same way, even though we might disagree with Baronel Stutzman, and I'm not saying I do, but even if I did, we should recognize it's her conscience that needs to be protected. If in her mind it is participating in a ceremony that's profoundly offensive to God, her right not to participate in this should be protected, just like the right of the Jehovah's Witness kids not to have to salute and pledge allegiance to the American flag should be protected. It's not a matter, we certainly don't want religious liberty to only protect proper or right belief, right? It must protect everything. Speaking of which, what about alcohol and drug use? A lot of evil has been caused by certainly the abuse of drug and alcohol. But even in America, of course, we had a long debate over this and eventually banned it. It's telling, though, that even when America banned alcohol, the Volstead Act, which was passed to implement this, contained a religious exemption. Because many of us are probably Protestants and we have communion with grape juice and we say, what's the big deal? But a lot of religions actually believe you got to use wine, right? The Bible says wine, you should use wine. So Roman Catholics and others, in certain Jewish ceremonies, wine is used. And so the Volstead Act protected the conscience, the ability of these religious adherents to have wine. So there's an exception to prohibition allowing for the sacramental use of wine. Most of us would say, yeah, that's fine, no big deal. Peyote, though, this is a little more difficult because a lot of us, even if we drink alcohol on occasion in moderation, and, you know, what's a big deal? But drugs, that's kind of this whole other category, right, of something that's really kind of scary. Peyote is a drug, and there are other drugs that are used in religious ceremonies. Now, the national government recognized as early as 1966 that there are religious rights of Native Americans that go back for hundreds of years. There is no question about this. This isn't just some frivolous idea for people who want to use drugs. There is no doubt about this. So in 1966, Congress exempted Native Americans. Actually, it was a very specific exemption for members of the Native American church to use peyote in religious exercises. But this is a federal law, so it applies to federal territories and reservations and this sort of thing. When it came to the states, some states had this sort of accommodation. Some states didn't. The great state of Oregon is one that didn't. And so he had this fellow, a poor Mr. Smith, who used peyote as part of a religious ceremony. He was employed by the state. The state has a no-tolerance policy for drug use, and so he was fired from his job, and he was not given unemployment benefits. And so the case went to the Supreme Court, and basically it came down to, does the First Amendment require that Mr. Smith's desire to use peyote in religious ceremonies be accommodated, to be protected. In Oregon versus Smith, I'm sorry to say, even though historically the court, certainly between 1963 and 1990, the court had a proclivity to say that if a law is going to infringe upon a person's religious belief or desire to act upon that belief, the state has to have a compelling interest behind that law, and it has to do so in the least intrusive means possible. In Smith, the court pulled away from that standard and it basically said, no, as long as the law is neutral, that is, it's not singling out religious actors or particular individuals, as long as it's neutral, no one gets to use peyote. That's a nice neutral law. And so, therefore, it's fine as a matter of constitutional analysis. If Oregon wants to exempt peyote, it can do so. So religious exemptions are fine, but they aren't required by the First Amendment. There was a national outcry about this decision, because, as I've suggested before, religious liberty is an American value. First of all, I'm happy to report the state of Oregon almost right away crafted an accommodation to protect Native Americans and actually others who want to use peyote as part of religious ceremonies. More significant, though, Congress came together and passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. This act was passed 97-3 in the U.S. Senate. 97-3, that means virtually all Democrats and all Republicans voted for it. It passed without dissent in the House of Representatives, and it was signed into law by President Bill Clinton, obviously a Democrat. And what was the purpose of this law? It was to raise the standard back to this old compelling interest standard. Basically, it said, look, if any state law or federal law seems to infringe upon a religious belief, we have to, the state or national government has to show a compelling interest, that it's a really, really, really good interest, and a and that it's doing so in the least intrusive means possible. So again, I want to, even as late as 1993, Democrats and Republicans could come together on this issue. And this was supported by a wide range of organizations, including some of the not usual suspects. I'm pretty sure the Americans United for Separation of Church and State were there partnering with the Christian Legal Society, because as much as organizations like that might frustrate some of us with respect to Establishment Clause issues, they do actually tend to be pretty supportive of the free exercise of religion. At least historically, this has been the case. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act was struck down as applied to the states a few years after that, which is why many of you are probably aware that some states have then passed their own Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. It still applies at the national level. This was a statute that was used to protect Hobby Lobby in the Hobby Lobby case of a year or so ago. So the statute's still around. It's applied to federal law, but not state laws, but states can do their own thing. If I can just add to this, almost right away, Congress amended the Native American Religious Liberty Act unanimously to better protect Native Americans. And then in, a few years after that, passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Person Act to protect the religious liberty of inmates and in certain land use controversies. Again, so this is, I'm trying to show a pattern here of respect for religious liberty. I have a bunch of other things. This will be the last major one I mention. Medical treatment. There are laws on the books requiring medical treatment, right? Vaccination being the most obvious, usually tied to school attendance. It used to be 48. Now only 47 states have exemptions for people who have religious objections to vaccinations. Again, public health, very important. Vaccination, almost all of us are in agreement on the science here. And yet still these states, most of the states, have found it necessary or have found it possible to exempt those relatively few people who have religious objections to vaccinations. Every state exempts people if there's medical objections. There are medical conditions whereby you shouldn't be vaccinated. Something like 17 states exempt people if they have philosophical objections. But religion is very well protected in this respect. Now, what happens? What happens if it starts becoming evident that maybe exempting people from the vaccination requirement is leading to diseases? And this is exactly what happened in California. So you had some measles outbreaks and other things among unvaccinated folks. And so California just this year revoked its exemption requirement. I think it went too far too fast. It could have gone less quickly. But I want to affirm that process. So don't hear me as arguing for every religious conviction ought to be accommodated. If there are good reasons not to, we ought not to do this. Probably the paradigmatic example of this, in the early 20th century, the Church of the Christian Scientists were able to convince many legislatures to craft out an exemption that would permit them not to give medical treatment to their children. All right? They believed that all illness is a result of spiritual matters and not physical matters, so therefore we don't want to use medicine or doctors. We want to simply pray for kids. Very unfortunately, literally hundreds of kids died because of these exemptions. And so states properly said, we're going to remove these exemptions. We have a compelling interest in requiring parents to get medical treatment for easily treatable diseases. That is a very appropriate sort of decision. But I think, and what I would insist upon, is that the state needs to show that there's a compelling interest and that they're doing this in the least intrusive means possible. Medical providers have been given great protection. Basically, I want to overstate it a little bit, but shortly after Roe versus Wade was decided, Frank Church, a Democrat from Idaho, said that nothing is more fundamental to our national birthright than religious freedom. Congress has to make sure to come up with the law so that federal funding is never used to force a doctor or nurse to participate in an abortion or medical procedure against which he or she has a religious conviction against his or her will. These sorts of exemptions, these sort of conscience clauses, they are called, have been significantly expanded so that doctors and nurses in some states, pharmacists, that have objections to participating in abortions, sterilizations, euthanasia, they can't be forced to participate in this. Again, I think very good accommodations to protect religious Americans. All right, even civil rights laws have religious exemptions, but I'm going to just skip through those to suggest I have a lot of good stuff here that I'll just skip so we can get on and talk about this sort of thing. Here's an interesting map of, it's maybe not well known, I'm not sure. Did you know that in half of the states you can discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and not run afoul of any law? Montana is such a state. So you could, if you're hiring for a position, you could just simply say, I'm hiring for this position and I'm not interested in hiring homosexuals. That might not be good for your business, it might be rude, it might even be showing a lack of Christian charity, but it's not illegal, okay? And so about half of the states prohibit this, the other half don't. The problem is these states that tend to prohibit this are also those that are probably some of the least religious-friendly states. So the accommodations for religious liberty tend not to be too very well protected other than churches and clergy. It seems to me this is a huge national debate, and where we go forward with this is going to be have to be something that probably is best worked out at the state legislature. But let me just suggest something that I find very heartening. And in suggesting this, I want to remind you that politics is the art of the possible. So we live in a country where no more than 70% of Americans identify themselves as Christians. And, of course, when we start talking about what percentage of those take their faith with any degree of seriousness, they actually go to church, they pray, and they do that sort of thing, it's significantly lower than that. So we have to take into account the fact that we live in a pluralistic country. It seems to me Utah just did a very, did something that's interesting that we should at least consider. So in Utah, there were no laws prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. They got together, a very conservative state, probably the most conservative state in the nation, right? And they brought both sides together and said, hey, why don't we come up with a compromise? We will pass laws that, in fact, prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, but as a part of these laws, we're going to have accommodations to protect private business owners so they cannot be compelled to participate in religious ceremonies against their sincerely held religious convictions. So both sides get something of what they want. And again, this hopefully leads to what I would say is a society of adults, whereby if you if a same-sex person goes to buy a wedding cake and a vendor says, I'm sorry, I can't sell that to you, the person goes elsewhere, right? No need for federal suits and state suits and this sort of thing. And yet you do have this sort of insidious discrimination that is prohibited. So I would say, I would hope, I suppose broadly, that legislatures in the various states, and maybe even at the national level, but I'd prefer to work at the state level, would look at this long history of accommodations and to say, look, historically, we've tended to say that if a state is going to have a law to promote something that's good, let's just stipulate, for the sake of argument, that laws banning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation are good. Let's stipulate that. I'm sure many don't agree with that. But assuming this is a good, is it possible to exempt people like Barrel-Nell Stutzman from these laws and still do whatever good this was intended to do? I would say example after example after example would suggest that it is possible. And particularly if we start thinking about this compelling interest. What is a compelling interest in making a florist participate in a particular wedding ceremony when there are literally dozens of florists willing to do this and, in fact, a number of volunteers for free flowers after this event? And of course, done in a very civil and kind manner. I would say there's almost no state interest, and certainly nothing approximating a compelling interest. So what I'd like to see, I guess, in terms of policy, are states moving. I love broad religious freedom restoration acts, but as we saw with the controversy in Indiana and even Arkansas, these just brought so many fears of, you know, kind of crazy homosexuals not being able to purchase groceries or hamburgers or this sort of thing, that maybe focusing on these more micro accommodations, specific limited accommodations, has a much greater chance of political success and could end up then protecting religious liberty better than it will be if we don't engage in this sort of advocacy. All right, so that's a lot of issues. I think it's about 11 o'clock, so why don't we stop there? And I know we want to get out of here by 11:10 or so, but if there's questions.
I've really loved how you walked through this, Tony. If I gave Tony the floor, he'd talk for 30 minutes because he loves this stuff. And I wish some of our legislators loved this stuff too, because I think one of our challenges is to try and educate them. You have questions?
A few months ago here in Billings, one of the judges of our state Supreme Court overturned a marriage amendment that a majority of Montana voters, you know, put added to our state constitution, and one judge just said it was unconstitutional, and then the very next day they were issuing same-sex wedding licenses. So I don't understand how one judge can just do that and get away with it. And that's my question, is how do we... It's not just happened here. It's happened in, you know, other states as well, you know, California and Prop 8 thing. So I just I don't understand how they can get away with that. So,
and especially when we have guns, so edit that out of the...
No, this is a great question. Some of us were talking in the break about where this power came from. You know, we could argue about this, and we could argue about the original intent of the American founders, but it's a pretty powerful consensus today among historians and political academics that John Marshall was right in Marbury versus Madison, where he said the Constitution is the law of the land, and it's ultimately the Supreme Court that gets to say what the Constitution means. And so if a democratically elected legislature or a democratically elected Congress passes a law that goes against the U.S. Constitution, it is, in fact, appropriate for a judge to step in and declare that law to be unconstitutional. Sometimes we like those results. I really like that result as it applied to Jehovah's Witness kids in West Virginia. That was a democratically created law. I'm going to presume it was maybe, I actually should look this up, I don't know, but let's say that law was approved by every legislator in West Virginia at that time, Democrats and Republicans. I think Justice Jackson was onto something. It's a part of our constitutional system to say, look, we're going to take some issues and say they won't be decided by the majority. Religious liberty is one of these. And so I think we do have an interest in recognizing this and saying, look, it is, again, Wisconsin versus Yoder. These Amish are a small, tiny minority. The Wisconsin legislature passed this democratically correct law. And I think the Supreme Court was right to step in and say, no, you can't do this. We're going to protect the religious liberty. So I don't necessarily have a problem with judicial review and striking down acts passed by the legislature. Again, you mentioned an initiative. In the great state of Oregon, there was an initiative that banned every private school. I think it was very appropriate for the U.S. Supreme Court to step in and declare that initiative to be unconstitutional. The problem I have with the Obergefell decision and these other decisions is what judges should be doing is actually interpreting the Constitution. And there's just nothing approximating a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And so these issues should have been left up to the states. If a state like Washington wants to legally recognize such marriage, I think it has a constitutional right to do so in our federal system. If Montana wants to not recognize that legally, I think you all certainly had the right. So I would join you in critiquing that particular decision, but not necessarily in critiquing judicial review wholesale. Does that make sense?
This is about the same-sex, you know, Supreme Court decision. And I'm not an attorney, and I didn't follow all the opinions, but I was always wondering the justices or even the Christian defense funds like you're representing, I never heard any biblical references to, you know, the fact that, you know, same-sex marriage is wrong. And, you know, we can quote, as Christians, we can quote Bible verses, but I guess my question is it because there's no reference to the Bible and the Constitution, or there's no reference to God, or it was really the 14th Amendment, so the justices had to stick to the specific 14th Amendment and they couldn't quote Bible verses to support their view? Is that why it was that way?
Yes, I would say so. I think, again, there's a general broad consensus that the job of justices is to interpret either the Constitution or statutes and not just, make whatever decision they think best or moral, even. A great example of this from the other side is really a pretty impassioned opinion. Justice Blackmun, in one of the death penalty cases, he was asked to say whether or not the death penalty was constitutionally permissible. And he writes fairly eloquently, I'm going to paraphrase, but basically he says, I hate the death penalty. I think the death penalty is immoral. As a legislator, I would vote against the death penalty. But as a judge, my job is to say whether it's constitutionally permissible or not. And it is. It is constitutionally permissible. And that, I would think, is taking the role of, it's a proper role for the judge. The judge should not be sitting there saying, well, this is morally correct, so this is a law. And even as much as I'm a Christian and I hold the Bible as the inspired word of God, I don't think it's a job of judges to say the Bible requires this, so therefore this policy outcome. So I think it's appropriate for the judges to be focusing on the law. My complaint, and if you read the dissenting, they're just really powerful. I think Roberts and Scalia and the others are exactly right. There's no good constitutional argument in favor of the outcome of Obergefell. This was a clear act of five justices saying this is the outcome we want. There's a nodding reference to the 14th Amendment, but even the analysis there is woefully lacking. So yeah, this was, if I were to make a list of some of the worst judicial opinions ever, not even just in terms of outcome, just in terms of the really sort of flimsy constitutional rationale, this would be very high on the list. Yeah, it's a horrendous opinion.
We've come a long ways from the enumerated powers, haven't we, too?
Absolutely.
Other questions?
I don't know if this is really a question or a lament, you know, that this principle of the judicial review is so important, but what can we do in our system if, as seems to be the case, our Supreme Court justices do not feel bound or, feel the right, as most of us here probably believe, to create rights that are not in the Constitution? I guess, do we just batten the hatches and wait for a different political climate when different justices might be appointed by a president with a different political view? Or it's quite frustrating. I mean, I think most Christians feel that justices have created rights here to abortion, to same-sex marriage, which they're not in the Constitution, but they have the right to say they are constitutional because we're the Supreme Court and we say they are.
Yeah, no, I'm very sympathetic. So when the court makes a decision purportedly based on the Constitution, the obvious thing that one could try to do, but it's almost impossible to do, is amend the Constitution, right? But this, of course, requires supermajorities, and there's no way we're going to be able to win the battle on that one through a constitutional amendment. So I'm afraid, as inadequate and as frustrating as it sounds, it really, a lot comes down to the next presidential election. You have two justices over 80. Whoever is elected president is certainly going to replace one, maybe two of them. I think it's an issue that hasn't come up as much as I would like, but I think it's really important to make sure that we elect someone that is going to interpret, that's going to appoint people who actually are committed to interpreting the Constitution and not legislating their own personal viewpoints. And even, say, Republican presidents over the years, some have taken this responsibility more seriously than others. When someone does, you get some really good outcomes, like Alito and Roberts. When you don't, you get David Souter or Sandra Day O'Connor that are less than stellar in many respects.
And I would add that, practically speaking, rubber hits the road type stuff. Go back to your church, talk to your pastor, your lead pastor, and get those roughly 50% of evangelicals that aren't even registered to vote registered.
I want to thank you, Dr. Hall, for showing us very clearly that religious accommodation is a longstanding American tradition, and it's extremely encouraging in this date. My question is regarding the Supreme Court. Wouldn't it be better to put those people on term limits and make them accountable to the voters instead of being appointed for life by the president?
You know, that's an interesting observation. In fact, when the United States basically helped Germany and Japan write their constitutions after World War II, instead of having justices serving for life, I think it was like you serve for 10 years or 15 years, and then you're off, which does a couple of good things, right? Some of these justices really serve well beyond where they should be serving in terms of their ability to do their job well. And it also creates a sort of perverse incentive if you're president to appoint someone as young and inexperienced as you can get away with so that person will be on a long time. So if we say, look, you get to this, Supreme Court justices serve for 15 years, then this kind of guarantees a rotation and it gives a president incentive to appoint someone who's maybe 50, 55, you know, some very experienced, but who still has a good 15 years of work, but then who will have to step away. I think that would be a good constitutional reform. Of course, it wouldn't necessarily, it would all depend upon who's elected president, how that would play out in terms of the ideological balance, assuming this was done on some sort of, you know, once every 2 years or something, someone rotates off. But yeah, I think that'd be a very sensible reform. In the history of the Supreme Court, there have been some instances where, I mean, just indisputably justices who are completely incapable of doing their duty, and yet they're just hanging on in hopes that either a Republican or Democrat would be elected in the next election who could then replace them. And that's just not good for our judicial system.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Compelling state interest. This intrigues me because I think about the abortion issue, you know, killing 50 million babies in America alone. And also, like, this same-sex marriage ruling has now opened the door. Even as I live in Lockwood, there's a polygamous couple that's petitioning the Yellowstone County to accept their polygamous marriage and how that will affect children. So can you address how we can, you know, all these questions, like, how can we do this? How can we hold these justices accountable for their, you know, is this a compelling interest of the state?
Yeah, this is a great question. And, of course, one of the problems with a test like that is that we would love for there to be bright lines in the law. This is clearly protected. This isn't. And it's just things don't work out that way. So my argument, and again, keep in mind there's a variety of levels of analysis here. Unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court no longer interprets the First Amendment to require this compelling state interest. So I find that to be unfortunate. But many states do, and the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act does. And so it's in play in some cases, but not in others. I would say it means what it says, which is not crystal clear, but the state has to have a really, really good reason for limiting someone's ability to act upon his or her religious conviction. So easy cases are someone who wants to sacrifice a child. That's pretty easy. I think also the case of the Christian Scientists who don't want to get medical treatment for easily treated disease. That's a pretty easy case. We can say, yeah, parents have rights, religious liberty is important, but the state's going to step in this particular matter and say, no, you will get penicillin for your child with pneumonia or something like that. With respect to a lot of these other issues, it seems to me evident that the state doesn't have a compelling interest in requiring Bill and Elle Stutzman to participate in the same-sex wedding ceremony. It doesn't have anything that's within a light year of a compelling interest. The case of polygamy is interesting, and particularly in light of Obergefell. It was sort of funny. One of the Roberts, in his dissent, he pointed out that Kennedy, in his majority opinion, just sort of randomly put in union between two people, union between two people, but there is no reason in principle why this union should be limited to two people, because basically it's a completely different view of marriage, which says marriage is all about affections, and if three people have affections for each other, why not allow them to be married? So particularly in light of Obergefell, I would be frankly surprised if these state statutes prohibiting polygamy among consenting adults are upheld. I think the logic of this decision, as bad as it would be to strike you down. But let's just leave Obergefell out of it altogether and say if we were just simply dealing with a straightforward religious liberty claim. So Montana makes it illegal makes polygamy illegal. A couple says we have a religious reasons for wanting to have this polygamous union. then I think the burden would be on the state to say no for these reasons, drawing from social science evidence, from historical documentation and whatnot. Certainly, if you go back, the case of the Mormons was really pretty easy because there was a ton of abuse within these early 19th century polygamous relationships, oftentimes not involving consent, young ladies at the age of 14, 16 being given to Joseph Smith and this sort of thing. And so the federal government could pretty easily, that wasn't the standard back then, but I think it could easily say, look, the abuses within these relationships, particularly as pertains to women, are just so great and obvious and evident that we're going to prohibit this altogether. And of course, you can always make the argument, I'm sure you can find a great example of three bright, articulate 30-year-olds who want to engage in this polygamous relationship that clearly is consensual. But very oftentimes, law has to be general, right? In the same way that it's certainly possible that a 17-year-old could consent to having sex with someone who's 19, we still say as a matter of law, no. This is going to be statutory rape because, you know, we can't take these odd exceptions. We need a more general standard. And so I think the burden would be on the state, but the state should be able to make a pretty good argument that statutes against polygamy are justified over and against religious freedom arguments.
If you have interest, and I hope you do, in this whole thing that we're talking about right now, I highly recommend to you Truth Overruled by Ryan T. Anderson. We have a few copies of that. Nancy and I were privileged to be with the Wyoming Pastors Network last week for 2 days, and Ryan T. spoke 3 times for an hour and a half. And he is the best of the best. He's 30 years old. It's criminal that somebody that young should be that bright. we'll add one thing that, you know, as I sat in one of their breakout sessions with the members only of the Pastors Network, one of the things that came up right after a federal judge ruled for same-sex marriage in Wyoming, the next day one of these three pastors put the network together, got a phone call about doing a wedding. The next phone call he got almost very soon after that was from his insurance company. And I won't take time to bore you with what happened, but he was asking questions like, do you marry people from outside of your church? Do you let people that use your, they happen to have a retreat facility. Do you let people from outside your church use your retreat facility? Because they're asking questions that are opening the door. So it was a very interesting conversation amongst these pastors. So here we are. And I mentioned Truth Overruled because one of the things I really think we need to guard against is just being complainers. You know, we can, I mean, we need to go out and have coffee and kind of commiserate. But these guys have got solutions.
Let me just
one add, other question.
If I can just add to this. I'm going to guess almost all of you are involved with your churches, with Christian organizations, with Christian schools. And it really is really a good idea to visit the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Christian Legal Society. They have some great material for what you can do to protect yourselves. Again, the clearer you can be in your bylaws and policies, laying these things out, and then consistently enforcing them. That becomes important. Again, I am less worried about churches, but even for churches, the clearer and the more consistent, the better. But absolutely, religious organizations, religious schools. There's a Christian college in Oregon that requires that they're, you know, they have a pretty traditional Christian statement of Christian sexual ethics or this sort of thing. But they had a physical education professor who everyone knew was in a same-sex relationship for year after year after year, and the college did nothing about it. And then all of a sudden she announced she's going to get married to her partner, and now all of a sudden the college wants to do something. This college, and again, I'm not an attorney, but I think it's in a lot more trouble than George Fox would be because George Fox pretty effectively and efficiently enforces its policies. In this case, the woman's going to argue, well, yeah, this policy was technically on the books, but it was ignored, and now all of a sudden they're bringing it up in an arbitrary fashion. The university's in far worse position than it would be if it had enforce this policy very, very systematically.
And ADF really covers churches, ministries, and businesses. And there's and the history thing that you're referring to, and their statements of faith, so to speak, even for businesses. How are we going to operate? And the history of that is important when we go into these cases. One more question, and then we'll give it up. No questions. Again, thank you for coming. If you can help us with a donation to pay for all of this, that would be appreciated. And we'll see you in January.
Thank you all.